this is the third side, 45-minute side, of May 1st, 2006. So as I was saying just at the end of the previous side, so LaRouche is an anti-environment, technological liberalism. He's not an anti-environment to Buddhism and or Catholicism or Croker's and Marx, though LaRouche writes on Buddhism and the Catholic philosophers and on Marx. He did a lot of writing on Marx in the late 60s and early 70s when the New Left was dominant in American political life. Basically because LaRouche was around students. Now, in one of my earlier interviews with LaRouche, he talks about how he did Marx and presented a different view of Marx, but within the Marxist, his own expertise, his knowledge of Marx, because he was a member of the Socialist Workers' Party in the 50s. He did that because that's what the students in New York that he was teaching and trying to influence were interested in, right? So he provided a way of looking at Marx in a new way. And we'll go into that later when we read the quotes in the book from LaRouche. So he's focusing, though, on new technologies, new hardware, new energy sources. So that's where his main focus is. McLuhan deals with, is not only just an anti-environment to Catholic Thomism. Well, we call him that because he's using, supposedly, as he states, a Thomist view of technology, or a Thomist view of the 20th century. And his concept of tactility is developed from his own understanding of Thomas Aquinas. He comments on Buddhism, on technological liberalism, on Marx. He comments on those guys. But mainly he's doing it from the fulcrum, we'll call it, the mountain view, the apex view of Catholic Thomism, just as LaRouche is commenting on everything around him from the world of technological liberalism, but mainly critiquing the technological liberals. McLuhan is critiquing the Catholics and how they don't understand the world of the 20th century. Thompson is critiquing Buddhism, New Age philosophy, theosophy, the occult, the esoteric. He's an anti-environment to that. More of that is his framework and his audience, and that's because he's mainly a 70s guy where a lot of that New Age stuff started. And the baby boomers got into it, and a lot of people got into non-Christian philosophies and mystical traditions, so that wasn't as prominent in the 60s. So that was, Thompson is an anti-environment to his time, the 70s. We have him dated on the chart as 1970. McLuhan is dated 1965, and that's before the counterculture and swamis and gurus and the Beatles, before the Beatles 67 got into the Maharishi, which had a big influence of bringing non-Christian theologies into the West, or into baby boomer culture. So Thompson is an anti-environment to Buddhism and that, dances on his toes, but he also takes on technological liberalism. That was the very reason he left MIT. He didn't like the corporate Norbert Wiener cybernetic tradition, the automated world that was starting to take over education at MIT. So he takes on technological liberalism. He definitely takes on the Catholic Thomas world and Catholic philosophers because he was raised as a Catholic and knew it. So he's taking on the McLuhan zone. And he takes on the postmodernists. Later, when the postmodernists surfaced in the 80s, he will critique them. So he's critiquing the Croker zone of Marxism, right? And the post-Marxist critics that Croker deals with. Now, Croker, dances on the toes and is an anti-environment to Marxism, but also the New Left and all the radicalism that came out of the 60s, from an anarchist point of view, or not an ideological, limited point of view, but he critiques technological liberalism, and I think it's from Croker I got the term technological liberalism. That was an 80s term for scientists and technocrats. Technocrat was the term in the 60s for what I'm calling, what LaRouche is an anti-environment to, the technological liberals. So Croker takes on the technological liberals, he takes on Catholic Thomism, he takes on McLuhan, he takes on the New Age people, but mainly, as we've seen in his latest book, he retrieves Marx and Heidegger and Nietzsche. he's including that. And so Nietzsche might be seen as an anarchist, and Heidegger, I don't know if he's seen as an existentialist, post-ideological. So Croker is still using Marx, Heidegger, and Nietzsche. I mean, he uses Nietzsche a lot in the 80s, and sees Nietzsche as the philosopher par excellence dealing with the coming 20th century virtual nihilism that we've seen unfolded up the last 40 years. He saw Nietzsche predicting that and coming up with a good description and critique of it. So Croker is standing on the shoes of Marx, Nietzsche, and Heidegger, standing on their toes and moving it past them and attacking or critiquing, erasing technological liberalism, Catholic Thomism, and Buddhism, or the New Age Theosophy kind of stuff. So that's why was I laying that out? That's how they're not limited to the categories I place them in. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So that's what I wanted to say about them, that little extra part.
All right.
There's nothing about, Marxism is not talking about logic and dialectics and rhetoric and grammar. Neither is Thompson, neither is LaRouche, neither is McLuhan in their writings in the 60s and 70s. But they're all aware of it. I mean, McLuhan made a big deal out of the four levels of exegesis, was part of the grammatical tradition of analyzing scripture and literary texts, four levels of exegesis. Thompson uses that. So he may not be an expert of the trivium and quadrivium like McLuhan was, but he is aware of the general classical tradition. LaRouche is, McLuhan is, Thompson is, and Croker is, but they're dealing with the 20th century, which is a whole new world of information and new forms of analysis and sciences and arts and entertainment. So that though I have labeled them as dealing with technological liberalism, Thomism, Buddhism, or Marx, really they are postmodern, holopathic updatings of those things in what they do. So, for example, LaRouche, any scientist reads LaRouche's science or philosophy, they'll think he's nuts. It doesn't make any sense. It's not part of their academic tradition. But if you see how LaRouche is an anti-environment to the failures of that academic tradition, or even of modern science and pharmaceutical companies, then LaRouche becomes interesting. It's like each one of these guys are mythic in themselves. They make up a new form of pattern recognition to dance on the toes of their particular meme. All right? Meme, M-E-M-E. So they, which makes up a new kind of science. Also, what's interesting about all four of them is that they're well-versed in science, art, literature. They're multidisciplinary. They're what's called polymath, P-O-L-Y-M-A-T-H. They're encyclopedic, and they're also tracking what's happening in the Android meme environment, or what we call the information society. They're well-equipped to handle to developments and new patterns and fads in the period from 1960 to 1990 with their polymath, traditional polymath expertise, but also their ability to keep up on what's been going on. What some stodgier intellectuals would call fads and fashions and pseudo-knowledge, you know what I mean? They looked at what, in quotes, was pseudo-knowledge or pseudo-fashions and created patterns around it, played anti-environments off it. That's what's unique. Now, people see LaRouche as some guy presented in the 80s as a guy who said the Queen smokes dope or pushes dope. And if you just know that little silly cartoon image, you have no background or no inkling of the volumes he writes every week within a certain repeated theme, but he's covering all kinds of areas. And you've read LaRouche magazines, and you see how much he produces.
Oh, yeah, no kidding. Well, he has a whole institute of scholarly people who support his work and contribute to it.
Right, it's like these various memes, technological liberalism, Buddhism, Catholic Thomism, Marx, and anarchism, almost become cult-like in the fragmented society we have now, so that LaRouche, to organize his anti-environment technology liberalism, had to form a cult, in quotes. You know what I mean? McLuhan, many people around McLuhan, and some of these people that developed McLuhan's work are considered McLuhanites or McLuhan cultists. Thompson could be considered to have fostered New Age cultists around his thinking. But cultism is not as dangerous as it used to be. Advertising is cultism. It's just the group mind that McLuhan predicted would take over our society. No longer the individual genius sort of doing his own operation as a one-man army corps. Today, there's so much to be done, you form a team. And teams are called cults. So yes, Croker, LaRouche has a powerful team. McLuhan, in his legacy with all the people that are influenced by him, has a powerful team. Croker has a powerful team of people working around C-theory and the journal C-theory. And Thompson has many people like Ken Wilber, many thinkers, New Age writers follow in the breakthroughs that Thompson made. So I think I wanted to say that. Okay. So then the fifth guy is me.
Yeah, that's right. So that wraps it up for the first four, LaRouche, McLuhan, Thompson, and Croker, who on your chart are characterized as tetrad managers. And Bob, the fifth, is the characterized as the pentad manager.
Right, do you have a little paragraph on me?
Yeah, I do.
Okay, let's hear that.
I apologize in advance for anyone who listens to this. It's there's a lot of jargon in it, and it's just me sort of waxing poetically about Bob and sort of a little self-indulgence here, and may not make sense to people who haven't studied Bob or who know more about Bob than I do, but here we go. Bob Dobbs is assigned to the lockdown Bob rule phase beginning in 1990 on the chart, which is not governmental because it is self-referencing and self-governing. Bob's job, like that of Adam, who named all the animals in the Garden of Eden, Bob's job is like that of Adam, who named all the animals in the Garden of Eden. This is like the Eskimo who does not distinguish the name of the thing from the thing itself, and so by naming the thing, brings it into high relief. But the animals Bob names were not made by God, but by man. Bob's electronic animals are made of language formed into technology, media animals which live inside the medium of language itself. These media animals began as extensions of man that further extended themselves in Baroque spirals of self-referential tetrad processes, sculpting language first into an analogical mirror of man and then into an analogical mirror of itself, not unlike an invisible eye turned inward, dimly seeing only its own form and infinite extension. In the beginning, the word created the first distinction and split the monad into the dyad, or the figure and ground, and in so observing this figure-ground relationship, the dyad thus became three. And while observing itself, observing the three became many. And the many became conscious of itself through the fourfold Mobius strip-like mechanism of the double figure-ground characterized by Marshall McLuhan as tetrads balancing and rebalancing ratios of proportions among proportions, or technological mixes and sensory mixes as subject to the laws of media. In the end, Bob, with Connie at his side in a grand finale, an act of ultimate defiance, dropped his pentad defenses, assumed the role of hexad manager, articulated the name of the beast, calling it Rumpelstiltskin, forcing it to give up its secret identity, collapsing the tetrad into the triad into the dyad, and the dyad into the monad, and thus healing the imaginary split that never was.
Very good, very good. Right. That's not bad. I think Sleeper's going to enjoy hearing that, and you could use that. Let's see, and you know, you'd like to have that on the website. Okay, that's very good. Let's see. The way we have it in the book, Vatican Communion with Bob Dobbs, is I present LaRouche, McLuhan, Thompson, and Croker as writers. We're excerpting their writings. Now, LaRouche does radio interviews. He He attends classical concerts. Thompson made a video, kind of a mixed media artwork at the cathedral in the early 90s called Mimi and the Illuminati, I think it's called. Think of that, M-I-M-I, and my later term, Android Meme. So they all work in different media, but basically we're taking quotes from their written parts of themselves, their output, and using excerpts and quotes from their books. But the way I'm presented in the book, which is at the end of the book, and present on both sides, both pages, left and right, therefore implying I'm swallowing the left or right position of the previous four people. That represents the Android meme or the electric environment, digital environment, swallowing up anybody who wrote a book or presented some kind of wisdom, logocentric or verbal or written wisdom. So Dobbs represents the Android meme swallowing up the basic 20th century post-literate culture. And so the content of the Dobbs stuff is not quotes from things I wrote, but are transcripts of dialogues I had with callers on my radio show with CKLN in Toronto from 1987 to 1991. Dave Neufeld, who just won a Canadian Juno for his work with the band Broken Social Scene, he produced the last two albums, and the most recent album won a Juno a month ago or so. Dave Neufeld had to make, under assignment and payment from Nelson Thal, wanted to make an album of my radio stuff. So he, to get a handle on it, he had to type it out as he listened to the audio tapes of the talk show dialogues. And in typing it out, he got a better understanding of me. It's like a form of translation. And then he went back and could organize the material for the album, the actual audio. But he gave me later, in 91, I told him I was doing this book, and he said, well, I have transcripts of a lot of stuff. And I said, oh, great, that I could use that as me, because what was I going to do for me, since I had not published anything too much at that point? So the transcripts are the written version of an oral tactile dialogue going on inside a radio medium. So that is the so that's non-literary, right? Basically, non-book is the content style of presentation of me, but it represents the electronic oral culture swallowing up the literate culture, which the first four guys are very involved in. Okay, so that's the symbolic role, and some of the terms that you were using in your little introduction are not developed on the radio. I don't have the term pentad manager. I don't even know if I used the term tetrad manager. I may have used tetrad manager in 93, 94 when I was on LA radio, which is when you first heard me. But I don't think I was using pentad manager. So,
no, I didn't become familiar with it until you unveiled the chart at Jerry's house.
Which would be 96.
Yeah.
I think 96. And so some of your description is it's accurate, but it's not the language, not completely the language used in the transcripts from my CKLN show. It certainly is what I meant and was able to spell out later. What I mean by that is what I meant in my role in the book. You see what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I am a replay of LaRouche, McLuhan, Thompson, and Croker. I would use fragments from their information, even present interviews with them, or tapings of them, mix it up on the radio show in CKLN in the late 80s. I was playing all four. So my polymath, my multidisciplinary thing, was to take these multidisciplinarians and mix their whole world into my stew. So just as McLuhan could say, name four figures, he would name Dante, Chaucer, Joyce, and Wyndham Lewis, say, as people that he would constantly refer to in his writings. He did a lot in the 60s talk about Joyce, Eliot, Pound, and Yeats, or sometimes Lewis. So he played with four guys. Thompson went on And those were, you know, writers from 50 years before McLuhan. Now, Thompson took people that were contemporary of him, four of them. He took the scientist Lynn Margulies, James Lovelock of the Gaia theory, Francisco Varela, the biological philosopher, cognitive philosopher, studied brain processes, and Ralph Abraham, a chaos mathematician, chaos being a term for new kind of mathematics in the late 70s, early 80s. So he's juggling four contemporaries, right?
Mm-hmm.
McLuhan's juggling the previous generation. LaRousse juggles. Who are the four people LaRousse juggles? Definitely Plato. Definitely St. Augustine. Definitely, who's the guy at the Council of Florence? Cardinal Cusa, C-U-S-A, right? Nikolai or Nicholas Cusa. So Cusa, and then either Schiller, Riemann. Yeah, let's say Riemann. So he's got Plato, he's got St. Augustine, he's got Nicholas of Cusa, and Riemann. Now, he goes into other people and contemporaries, but there's easily, and you know enough of his writing, there's the four guys he's juggling with, right?
Mm-hmm.
Did I leave anybody out? No, that's it. So, I juggle four guys. Now, remember, we're generally male things going on here, which is the literate environment, the world of books, is a male-dominated world for 2,000 years because, according to McLuhan, literacy favors the left hemisphere and put women and other oral cultures in subservience. The electric age, especially after World War II, broke out of that. And feminism had a revival, and baby boomer women, Western women, had new wealth, new autonomy, new mobility, able to drive around their cars and listen to radio and all this stuff. That happened in the 50s, 60s and on. Women came to bay. The right hemisphere took over as an effect of the electric and digital environment. So I used to say on the radio that I'm a woman, a black woman. And black was the reference to tactility. And being on the electric media, I'm being tactile. So I was consciously using the black hole of tactility and knowing it was right hemisphere in favor of the woman. That's why I'm like the woman swallowing the whole male legacy represented by, and its factions represented by LaRousse, McLuhan, Thompson, and Croker, right? Now, Croker is a precursor of me more than they because he worked with his wife. He included his wife in his work. McLuhan didn't, LaRousse didn't, and Thompson didn't. But what's interesting is that LaRousse does bring his wife Helga into his work in the middle 70s and into the 80s once he marries her. I think he marries her in the late 70s. So he, as a latecomer, changes it. I mean, he did a whole bunch of work for 20 years before he had a woman involved with it. But he created a clone woman, in a sense, Helga, to carry on his male knowledge, right? And his take on male left hemisphere technological liberalism. So it's interesting. You have McLuhan, you have LaRousse working with a woman doing a left hemisphere thing. McLuhan keeps his woman, his wife, Corinne, secret and very important in his private life. As a private part, but she's not part of his public work. Thompson does not have a wife that's part of his public work, but he makes a big deal out of the new Christianity, the new religion, the new Aquarian religion will be a equal relationship between male and female. So that's part of his yogic esoteric ideologies, including women. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
Croker creates has a woman working with him, but not a clone of his work. Croker always gave great credit to her, to her understanding of postmodern information, that she was able to come up with patterns that Croker would include, or she even co-wrote some of the stuff in the book. So, and she's a designer in her own right. So there's a little more baby boomer level of equality between, and uniqueness and autonomy in their relationship than LaRousse had with his wife, right?
Yeah, although there probably aren't any women who actually have published on the level of Baudrillard or Croker in that arena.
What, you mean among my four people? Or
In the world.
Oh, no, there are. There's Lucy Irigaray. There's all kinds of postmodern women.
Okay.
Yeah, you may not have read them. You have to be probably a student in school to read them. And there's
I think a lot of women find this postmodern abstraction to be not compatible with their feminine sensibilities.
Well, no, that's your lack of being educated. I mean, you were educated in the 60s, so you're a little old-fashioned here. A lot of the leftists, what's called the Left Academy, is feminism. Feminism changed the academy in the 70s and 80s. And a lot of the postmodern academy is due to women.
Mm.
And there's all kinds of women who become famous. One of the major ones is Donna Haraway, a heavy postmodern thinker. You can see an interview, or you can see her speaking at Victoria University of Victoria on a C Theory website. You can see a broadcast in the archives, video archives, of her presentation to the Croker's class.
The reason why I made that assumption is because very often I see women as being more sort of integrated into the body, into the physicality of life, and some of these ideas become so abstract the body almost becomes discarded in the process, and I don't think that's an innate feminine sensibility.
Okay. I have it on my chart, the Thompson Quadrant symbolized by cowgirl. A lot of the women you're thinking of are New Agers.
Mm-hmm.
All right?
I'm not thinking in terms of intellectual categories. I'm just thinking in terms of, women birth children and suckle babies, I don't mean this as a put-down. I mean, I think we all need to be more in our bodies. You know, a lot of us have become abstracted to the point where, we don't actually appreciate being in the body.
Okay, let's take your word abstract. The way McLuhan and Croker use abstract, it's a physical body, but it's a TV body. It seems abstract and in the brain or inner space compared to the chemical body, which has a male and female type. It's the actual physics of the TV and the chip body, the actual grounded bodiness of it, that McLuhan and Croker work from. So if you call it abstract, you're putting a left hemisphere projection on something. You're moving back into concept. The percept is that electricity is a body, Croker McLuhan used this, and it favors the right hemisphere. It is not limited to the woman form. The woman's chemical body cannot handle the effects of the TV chip body because it's post-gender. So, Croker, in his book, The Postmodern Scene, he and his wife say that feminists are postmodern physicists. I think that was the phrase. That feminism is the new physics, the new quantum physics, the new post-quantum physics. And so you see, they're seeing that women, the discarnate people, are like we imagine the chemical body of women are, but it's more than that. So, and I'm saying a lot of...
So you're looking at this as an enhancement to biology?
Yes, that's McLuhan and Croker's point. Thompson sees that a little bit, but backs off a bit. LaRouche sees that, but does not take a postmodern stretch on it. He calls McLuhan a media fetishist, that McLuhan makes too much out of the fact that technology's nature.
See, I recall when John Lilly wrote the book The Scientist, and he talked about this, what he perceived as this emerging battle going on between the carbon-based biological creatures of our planet and the solid-state entity, which, the solid-state entity, you think of it in those terms, the solid-state entity is inhuman. So...
But that would be the chip and TV body, and the carbon would be what I call the chemical body.
Right.
So Lilly was dealing with that. In the Thompson Quadrant.
Right.
He was kind of a New Ager and into astral coincidence.
So the thing that's kind of frightening maybe until you get a deeper initiation into this, what we're going into here is the idea of this sort of cold, inhuman, calculating machine,
yes,
becoming part of our of our humanity. It feels like maybe we're losing our humanity in the process.
Okay, now this is what's important. I'm glad we came into this because I get the opportunity to explain why LaRouche, McLuhan, and Thompson and Croker get picked. When we get into the LaRouche quotes, you will see that LaRouche considers technology as an addition to nature, that it is new nature, the same point McLuhan works from, and that Thompson eventually works from, and that Croker does. So, of the technological liberalists, LaRouche is the most radical, at least in the 1670s. By the 80s, the cyber scientists take over and they begin to deal with the silicon body. But when we go into the quotes, we'll see that all four of them are looking at technology as nature, as not inhuman. That to see it as cold and human is, on the basic essential level, is a rearview mirror projection of immature minds. And each one of them would give a reason why that mind is mature, a different cause, is immature, give a different cause. So that the four of them are not that different. But what's interesting is that LaRouche takes, let's say, the dialectical view of the fact. Machines are second nature, is getting very close to first nature. And McLuhan takes a rhetorical grammatical look at it. A rhetorical look at it. Thompson does a grammatical view of the fusion of first and second nature, and Croker takes an anarchist view of it. So that's something we needed to say. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
And that's...
Croker's anarchist view being a distaste, in a way, or what do you mean by anarchistic view?
Celebrating the anarchy and the multi-gendered new sexuality that comes in with digital people with more than one body, celebrating the sexuality of four bodies.
The horny device that Zappa refers to in Joe's Garage.
yeah, that's right. That's why it's in there. Now, that's on the chart for anybody who's listening. What I wanted to say about that, the four, so... understand. Oh yeah, a friend of mine used to say in the late 80s, say, "Well, Bob, you're trying to make a synthesis between McLuhan and LaRouche, and these people that can't work." Well, yeah, on the surface, they can't be synthesized. But the underlying, if you know their work well enough, the underlying pattern, they're both talking about second nature as first nature, and that's unique. So there is an underlying similarity. And we'll get into why they're different or how they're different when we go into each section's quotes. So that's important, what we just did, developing the cold and human aspect of each one of them, and or how apparent cold and human aspect, or how they handle in a subtle way the cold and inhuman. Okay?
Okay.
So let's see. So we're talking about me. So I represent the, since McLuhan said, and Thompson and Croker and LaRouche would say that there's an interesting miming of our chemical body or of our basic first nature constituents by second nature and technology.
Mm-hmm.
So that very mimetic process is what I represent in a sense that I juggle the four thinkers and perceivers and the four memes and represent how the and/or meme presents them today. So, for example, since the chart is a picture of the 90s, which is a replay of the period from 60 to 90, it is a mirror of, the chart is representing the replay of Thompson, Croker, McLuhan, and LaRouche. In me, by me, and every one of them had a revival in the 90s. All right? LaRouche got out of jail, expanded even bigger than he was before. McLuhan had a big revival. Thompson was brought back to the Cathedral of St. John the Divine and was used in the Roth School and got a lot of books published in the 90s. And Croker was the McLuhan, in quotes, of the 90s. So I was revived in the 90s by Nelson Tall's albums and other things that I did, Flipside Magazine. And I'm like a homeopathic, which is a tiny hologram, homeopathic made up of the words homeopathy and hologram. I'm a hologram, but a tiny version, with aspects of each one of those four memes and persons and worlds, and the media they represent, the media biases and sensory ratios, which are laid out in the chart. So that's what...
You're, in a sense, outside and orbiting all of them?
And inside them, mm-hmm. In and out. I'm like the electric media. It's what's outside of us and inside of us at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm very noble of their work, but also dancing and critiquing and satirizing each one of them.
Mm-hmm. And Android meme is a term that you coined?
Yes.
And you might want to explain that a little bit, since you've used it but haven't really described it.
Right. Since in the Information Society of 1960-1990, no categories had any staying power. And therefore, any meme had any staying power, because we lived in a constant electric regeneration of information patterns 24/7. McLuhan discussed the rhetorical ramifications of that. LaRouche discussed the dialectical, scientific ramifications of that environment. Thompson, the grammatical, etymological nature roots of that situation, of that pattern. And Croker dealt with the political dimensions of it, put in simple terms. So each pattern has no staying power. So therefore, there's room to improvise on each tradition or meme: technological liberalism, Catholic communism, Buddhism, and Marxism. And all those four characters do their own spin, and it's not even recognizable within the tradition. But that's because you have to invent a new pattern dealing with the obsolescence of any meme anyways. Android meme is the replay of those obsolete memes, which have no ground, the staying power. The Android meme is, in a sense, the fake meme, the fake representation of them, the fake mythic replay of them. And that is also real, because we know in virtual reality that the fake is a viable environment. The TV body and the chip body are viable environments. So the Android meme is a chip body version dealing with the thought memes and schools of perception and thought that have come down, especially in the West, and became global in the 20th century, that each one of those guys represents. You see?
Yeah.
So it is technology replaying the very patterns of thought and perception that were solid schools up to 1960.
And when you refer to it as the fake meme, fake replay, that's not juxtaposed to a real meme or a real replay. You're saying that's all there is.
That's right. It's the afterimage of it's the post-human world, what some people call post-human, and post-thought, post-human thought. It's the machines are doing all the thinking and the pattern recognition and dumping it in the human's lap. Humans on the sideline. But the Android meme, as it progresses in the 90s, makes the human seem more involved and less having it dumped on the lap. The human thinks that they are modulating and creating new patterns. Take blogs. Blog guys look at the news or whatever field they're into, and they call them on it every day. Instant pattern recognition. Instant meme generation about whatever meme they're looking at.
Mm-hmm.
So the meme is defined by me as a viable human creation that is subsumed and replayed by something that, for most people, is inhuman.
Yeah.
But we're trying to train them to see that it isn't necessarily inhuman. So that's what it is, an Android meme. So I am the Android meme in the book, replaying the viable memes that those four guys did, and those guys were creating fake or postmodern or virtual versions of solid memes that existed before their lives, or in the first half of their lives, so to speak. Definitely didn't exist by 1960. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And they all surfaced in after 1960. LaRouche, McLuhan, within the Android meme, which I define as the period 1960-1990. And then in the 90s is an afterimage of Android meme. Even it has disappeared. So that makes me pretty invisible, because I'm replaying in the 90s what I replayed in the 80s. So in the 80s, I'm doing the Android meme, and that's largely what you get in the book, text from the late 80s, early 90s. But by the middle 90s, I'm replaying the afterimage of myself doing the Android meme, which was a replay of those four schools.
And this is where you're looking at media and you're abstracting human beings out of the picture, and you're just looking at media as though human beings don't exist or aren't part of the program.
Yes, but as the Android meme shrinks and disappears, it features and looks more like the anthropomorphic physical, so it hoists up LaRouche, McLuhan, Thompson, and Croker as great thinkers, great perceivers. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And saying, look, there is a human dimension. Look, these people are important.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah. I pierced that.
So you're assuming the
view. Hear that? I pierced that illusion.
You're assuming the viewpoint of the Android meme.
Yes.
That isn't to say that human beings aren't actually participating in running technology and in being involved in the development and extensions of technology, and aren't equally as important on the planet Earth as the Android meme. It's just that from the point of view of the Android meme, that's not true.
Right. That question about how important humans are in relation to our time, and we'll call human the chemical body, but then that's the Western version of our physical body. Just say, well, how important is first nature, and what do we think first nature is in relation to all the humans created called second nature? So that is the question. That's the question on the back of the book. Hand signals for the blind?
Mm-hmm.
Question mark. How human are we? Zappa used to say, what time is it?
Mm-hmm.
That was his question. Was there even time?
Mm-hmm.
So we think of time as a human dimension. Mm-hmm. So that is the question that those four people in the book are exploring, and I'm exploring that too.
Mm-hmm. So, just kind of a quick review of some points that you made in the last 30 minutes or so. LaRouche is a critique or an anti-environment of technological liberalism. McLuhan is a critique of Catholic Thomism. Thompson, a critique of Buddhism and the mystics. And Croker would be an anti-environment to the Marxist or anarchistic tradition. And then Bob being the constant electric regeneration of information patterns 24/7 subsumes all four of these guys. But the question that comes to mind is that these guys are all anti-environments to each other. Bob's an anti-environment to LaRouche, McLuhan, Thompson, and Croker, which means that everything here is everybody's relative to everybody else. So is there an underlying or a solid ground underneath all these relativities?
Well, it's a good question, because that brings us to the end of our introduction in these two sessions, and brings us to the title of the book, Thaddic Communion. And so the ground in the interplay between these guys and myself is an interaction defined by the phrase thaddic communication. Thaddic communication was the term discovered by Malinowski in his studies of the Trobriand Islanders in the Pacific Ocean in the late teens, early 20s. And when he came back to London, in some form, he encountered Mr. Ogden and Mr. Richards, who were putting a book out called The Meaning of Meaning. And whatever point they thought they were trying to make, and it was a structuralist in linguistics, it's just the beginning of structuralism, at least in England. The French Saussure began structuralism, Du Saussure, just before that, end of the 19th century. They encountered Malinowski, and he showed him his paper on how the tribal people communicated, and he noticed that there were artifacts in their culture that held the culture together more than any verbal holding together, concepts or verbal exchange. And he coined the phrase, this underlying cement in the society. He called that kind of communication that was going on phatic, P-H-A-T-I-C. So he coined the word phatic, as far as I know. And so they added, in the last minute, they added the appendix to the book, The Meaning of Meaning, this essay by Malinowski laying out his big discovery about phatic communication, which was a strange glue from Westerner, logocentric Westerners' point of view, literate Westerners. That book came out in early 1923, so it was in 1922, interestingly, that this interaction happened and consolidated the book. There was another guy, I forget his name right now, just to come to my head. He was a Czechoslovakian structuralist, Jakobson, or Jacobson, but I think they pronounce the soft J, so it's Roman Jakobson. So Jakobson, in the 50s, laid out different kinds of communication, and he used the term phatic, and I assume he got it from Malinowski, but he added another meaning to it. He used examples of people when they're talking on the phone, and if you're talking to me, or I'm talking to you right now, and you're going, you're verbalizing these little grunts and that, you're telling me to keep going. You know what I mean? Keep talking. So you're, like you did just then, that's right. A phatic expression in Jakobson's terminology. So he meant phatic as keeping it going. All right?
Keeping the ball rolling.
Yeah. And, I mean, it has no content, but it means something when you go, mm-hmm. So there's an, he adds to the meaning of phatic, and maybe his meaning is what people are taught in school and in colleges in the 70s, 80s, and 90s, because Jakobson was a major text in